This is Radioactive Magazine, a KKFI public affairs program of progressive activism, opinion, and commentary. Opinions expressed on this program are those of the speakers alone and are not necessarily the views of KKFI, its staff, volunteers, board of directors, show hosts, or other guests on the program.
Okay, good evening. This is Craig Lubo, and thank you for joining us on this edition of Radioactive Radio. Tonight's topic is the death penalty, and we're going to be focusing on what's happening in Kansas. And my guest tonight is Mary Sloan, and she's the executive director of the Kansas Coalition Against the Death Penalty. Welcome, Mary.
I'm very happy to be here. Thank you so much for giving me this opportunity.
Okay. And can you tell us what is the Kansas Coalition doing?
The Kansas Coalition Against the Death Penalty is a single-issue 501c3, which is whose only mission is repeal of the death penalty in Kansas, and we're working on repeal in 2015.
Okay, and what is the legislation that is pending in Kansas at the present time?
We have two bills. We have Senate Bill 126 in the Kansas Senate that is residing in the Judiciary Committee and did have a hearing, but has not had a vote and is not expected to move out of committee this session. In the House, we have Senate Bill 2397, which is in the House Federal and State Affairs Committee. It has not had a hearing this session and probably will also not move out of committee this session.
Okay. And is there a bill to change the appeals process? Is that one of them?
That's correct. Most of our effort this session has been in trying to stop passage of a Senate substitute for House Bill 2389, which is characterized by proponents as a reform of the appeals process, and by those of us who are very concerned about it as a poorly thought out bill, which will, in an intention of speeding up the appeals process, raise some serious risk of execution of innocent persons.
And what are some other factors? Is there an adverse effect that you would expect it to have on people who are not death penalty cases as well?
Yes, it would put other cases behind death penalty appeal cases and slow down the process for other cases as well.
Okay, and speeding up the process, how does that, you're saying it would have a negative effect and that would risk execution of innocent people. How does that impact that?
I can just give you one example. This afternoon I spoke with Tom Goldstein, who grew up in Prairie Village, Kansas, and is a graduate of Shawnee Mission East. Tom was accused of murder in California and was implicated by a jailhouse informer who was later found to have provided false information. But it was not provided in timely fashion, and Tom ultimately served 24 years of a 27-year sentence before he was exonerated. And so if the appeals process, he was not sentenced to the death penalty, but if he had been, the appeals process took so long that if the appeals had been expedited and shortened in California, as this legislation would do in Kansas, he might have been executed before he could have proved his innocence.
Okay. And what was the method what was the basis that he was able to become exonerated in his case?
The false testimony of the informer was brought forward after a laborious effort on his part. There's another case of a gentleman who's been here and spoken in the Kansas City area who was incarcerated in Oklahoma, and his conviction was based on evidence that had been tampered with. And it was actually the FBI that brought it to the attention of the authorities that the evidence that was key in his conviction, and he was sentenced to death, fortunately, the wrongdoing on the part of the lab came forth before he was executed. So those are the kinds of things that we're concerned about if you speed up the appeals process and limit briefs to 100 pages and dictate to the court how fast they must respond and limit the appeals that a person can make based on having had an ineffective assistance of counsel. So those are some very serious concerns about this bill. The other serious concern about this bill is that it was passed in the House and then sent to the passed in the Senate and then sent to the House using a procedure that's known as a gut and go procedure, where a previously passed bill, the contents are removed and the new bill is inserted into it. It's then sent over to the other legislative body from the House of Origin, and it can go through an expedited process there as well. This would have deprived the House of Representatives of being able to debate, research, and seriously consider these serious provisions that could result in loss of innocent life and miscarriages of justice. So between some concerns about the bill, the provisions, and concerns about the process, the House of Representatives voted to send it back to a conference committee, and we're very happy that they've done that.
Okay. And I think when you referred to the person in Oklahoma, were you talking about Curtis McCurdy?
McCarty, yes, McCarty. I was.
Okay. And his case, he was exonerated because the lab technician had basically forged the results?
That's correct.
And that was many years later when that was discovered, is that correct?
That's correct.
So if they had a similar bill, if they had streamlined appeals, he would probably have been executed before that could have been discovered.
Yes, that's unfortunately correct.
Okay. And when you're, in terms of the reasons why you would support abolition, what are some of the key reasons?
There are many reasons that people support abolition of the death penalty. They range from the fact that the cost to the taxpayers of Kansas is 3 to 4 times higher for having the death penalty than for having the maximum sentence be life without parole. That was just brought forward in a study by the Kansas Judicial Council. And so that's a very compelling reason and a very pragmatic one. Many people are opposed to it because of their religious beliefs, that they have a healthy respect for life, that they feel that our Maker gives life and should take life. And so they support legislation that does not allow the state to interfere with that process. There are people who are very concerned about the fact that it's not a deterrent. It does not do anything to prevent crime taking place. So then there are concerns about those who are innocent. There are many, many miscarriages of justice in the justice system in Kansas and in other states. There are many inequities in the system, so that the death rows throughout the country are more populated with people who have less in terms of personal assets and are persons who are members of minority populations. So there are many, many concerns about the death penalty. It has not served any state well. It has been repealed by 18 states. And we're looking for repeal in Kansas.
And Kansas is not immune from the problem with wrongful convictions, is it?
Certainly not. Another exoneree who came and spoke here in the Kansas City area is Eddie Lowry, who was not convicted of murder but was convicted of another very serious crime. And actually, under pressure from police officers, confessed to a crime he did not commit, served his entire sentence, and then it was many years afterward that before he was exonerated. That may seem amazing to people that someone would confess to a crime that they did not commit, but in Eddie's case, he most certainly did that, and then served a long sentence and then worked very hard to have his name cleared, which he did do. And again, it was DNA evidence that cleared him, so he was definitely not the perpetrator.
And when inmates are trying to clear their name, at least in terms of those who are genuinely innocent, a lot of them don't have access to DNA testing.
That's correct, and DNA evidence is not available in every case.
And so when it's not available, it may take even many years longer than it would if there were DNA evidence.
Yeah, and it can take a long time to get your hands on the DNA, even if it does exist. The very first person in the country who was exonerated through DNA evidence is Kirk Bloodsworth. And Kirk was convicted in Maryland twice and identified by five eyewitnesses as the perpetrator of a horrible crime, a murder of a nine-year-old girl. He did not commit it. And he was able, finally, after serving, you know, a long time, including, I think it was 9 years on death row in Maryland, in some of the harshest prisons, he was able to get his attorney to get his hands on the DNA evidence and have it tested, and he was then immediately exonerated.
Okay. And you work with families that have victims, that some of which do, in fact, support abolition. And
we certainly do. At this station, Vicki and Syl Sheber came and spoke about that. Their beautiful 23-year-old daughter, Shannon, was murdered while a graduate student, and they are vocal proponents of repeal. Vicki works for the Catholic Mobilizing Network, and Vicki and Syl speak across the country for repeal. They talk about how the appeals process is difficult for the families as the case keeps coming up again and again, and the memories are reignited. And so the pain and suffering of the families goes on. Additionally, they talk about the need for forgiveness and for not letting that hatred that is quite normal to feel be bottled up inside of the family members who are left behind. And we've heard that from other murder victim family members as well, that it's a hard path for forgiveness, but it is a very necessary one for the families of those who are left in the wake of the murder of a beloved family member.
One of the upcoming episodes that I'm going to have here is an interview that I did with Billy Moore from Georgia, and he was on death row, I think, around 20 years, and ultimately got his sentence commuted, and it was based upon several years of hard work from the family that opposed his execution.
Wow.
Now, you indicate, or one of the things that I've heard some proponents suggest is that there's closure for families. Have you ever actually met a victim's family that felt like there was closure after there was an execution?
I have not met anyone who has said that. In fact, I have met murder victim family members who say that the closure comes when the person is sentenced to life in prison without parole, and it ends right there. You know, there are different ways of seeing that, but I've certainly heard more of it's better that it ends right there the day the person is sentenced to life in prison and the family doesn't have to go through that process.
And are there cases that either your organization or others that you've communicated with, are there any cases where they have actually proven or exonerated somebody after they were executed?
There are some suspected cases. Certainly there are cases where someone has been cleared and it's too late because they've already been executed. I can't cite the names of the cases, but I do know that there are cases where there's very strong evidence that someone who has been executed did not commit the crime for which they were executed, and that is something that no one, no citizen, no legislator wants to know that they have done.
Okay, and when there's cases like that, some of the famous cases like the Willingham case in Texas and the case in Arkansas, the West Memphis 3, I think they referred to it as. And then there was the, I don't remember his first name, the Ferguson case from Columbia.
Right.
And
Ryan Ferguson.
Ryan Ferguson, thank you. And in those cases, they don't, let me rephrase that. The, when they're, in terms of media coverage is what I want to get at. In those cases, if the media had not been covering it, those were famous cases where CNN, I think, did some specials. NBC Dateline did some specials.
That's right.
If those cases had not been covered like that, what is the likelihood that those people would have been exonerated or released?
Well, I think it's very important. The media plays a very important role in informing and educating all of us about miscarriages of justice, whether they're on the level of the Willingham case or in any of the other cases that you mentioned. You know, without some attention to the facts surrounding the case or the lack of facts surrounding the case, it might be that people never come to know that there have been miscarriages of justice, and they would not see the harm that the whole death penalty process inflicts on society. So I think the media has a very important role in bringing those situations to light and bringing attention to them and to helping to educate the public.
Okay. And the media, in a sense, then, is really kind of a double-edged sword, because sometimes their coverage is might be what causes somebody to be convicted of something they didn't do, but then at the other end, they're doing stories that sometimes help exonerate somebody.
Well, I think the media has a very positive role to play, and I think also that voters and legislators and society has a role to play in making sure that the laws carry out justice. And for us, we believe that that should mean life in prison without parole and not the death penalty.
And the advantage, of course, of life in prison is that you don't execute somebody that's innocent, because they might be in prison for 20 years, but ultimately they may be able to establish their innocence.
That's right. I mean, no one can give Kirk back the years that he spent in prison. No one can give Tom Goldstein the 24 years that he spent in prison, wrongfully in prison. No one can give that back to anyone. But as I believe Kirk said, that, you know, if you've executed someone, you can't undo that. You can release someone who's been wrongfully convicted and imprisoned, but if you've executed them, it's too late. So that's a very compelling reason to make the maximum sentence life without parole.
And when you're talking to victims' families, and you talk to a lot of these families that have forgiven them, or for one reason or the other, do not want them executed, what is the difference between what you see, how those families arrived at that conclusion, versus families that support the death penalty?
Well, you know, a family who's been through that has been through an unspeakable horror. There's no doubt about that. That is probably the worst thing that anyone who is a parent can think about, or a brother or a sister. You know, that it's an unspeakable tragedy. But it is a personal decision for the families, and there are many families who have come to that decision through the basis of their faith. Some have gone through a process of many years before they came to that conclusion about forgiveness and letting go of the pain and the bitterness. It's a very personal decision. I would not presume to, you know, to advise anyone how to feel when they've been through the ultimate tragedy.
Okay. And in terms of what, if somebody supports abolition or opposes the one bill that you mentioned that would speed up the appeals,
right,
what can they do to help promote abolition?
Well, a lot of our members and the general public have already been very helpful in communicating with the House of Representatives that they should slow that reform of the appeals process bill down, Senate substitute for House Bill 2389, and slow that down and urge the House to take their time. These are serious matters, to have a look at that, and not to be rushed into anything. And so that, you know, is something that people have already done. Likewise, as we push for repeal and hope that our bills will make it out of committee next year and will get passed by the House and Senate, you can communicate with your legislator, and you can let them know how you feel about it. You can educate yourself through our website, www.ksabolition.org, or the Death Penalty Information Center has a lot of good information. You can educate yourself about the death penalty and learn about the fact that it's not a deterrent, that not every family wants the death penalty for the person who took their family member, that there are inequities in the system, that there have been quite a number of exonerees who needed time to be able to establish their innocence. So you can educate yourself on all that. You can share it with other people, particularly share it with your legislators, and support repeal as it goes forward in 2015.
Okay. And you were mentioning before how DNA evidence may not be available for a long time. And one of the things that occurred to me that a lot of people probably are familiar with was a couple years ago there was a movie called Conviction about a guy who was put on death row for a murder in Massachusetts and then later exonerated. And if I recall correctly, it took them, and that was actually a true movie based on the actual case, it took them 16 years just to get to the DNA evidence before they could even ask to have it tested.
So. Absolutely. It can take a long time and money to get your hands on the DNA evidence if it does exist, if it's been preserved, and to have it introduced in your appeals.
Okay. We're just about out of time. Thank you for joining us, Mary.
Thank you so much.
And as I indicated before, June 3rd, we will have the episode where we'll play the interview with Billy Moore.
That'll be great.
And I also will have, on some episode, either in June or July, we will have Curtis McCarty will join us.
Great.
Via telephone. So
that's
thank
wonderful.
You all for joining us, and join us again next Tuesday as well. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Dave Mitchell with Global Warming Corner. On March 31st, 2014, the United Nations International Panel on Climate Change released its Working Group 2 report. This report assesses the impacts, adaptation, and vulnerability of natural and human systems to warming of the climate. On March 31, 2014, PBS NewsHour's Judy Woodruff interviewed Michael Oppenheimer of Princeton University, a coordinating lead author of Working Group 2, and Patricia Lankow of the U.S. Center for Atmospheric Research, a sociologist. From the released report, Ms. Woodruff noted climate change is already causing harm through flood, drought, and food shortages, and these will worsen quickly if immediate action is not taken. Mr. Oppenheimer stated the whole system we live in is being affected. For example, he points to far more areas worldwide with declining crop yields than those with increasing yields, saying that's a bad sign. He also said there has been a change in the frequency of heat waves, which kill many vulnerable people, particularly the elderly. Ms. Lankow notes the 2003 European heat wave resulted in 35,000 people killed, primarily elderly. Mr. Oppenheimer points to, quote, massive changes in globally important systems, like the Arctic or coral reefs, on which people's lives depend. Ms. Lankow commented negative impacts of a warming climate in the U.S. are widespread and substantial. Retreating glaciers are affecting water supplies on the West Coast. There has been mortality related to heat waves, and our forest, water resources, animal and plant species we love are negatively affected. In response to Ms. Woodruff's question, what are the most important things to do now, Mr. Oppenheimer advocated for regulations to eliminate carbon emissions from coal plants. This is an extremely strong assertion, reflecting the urgency of the problems facing us. Mr. Oppenheimer makes the excellent point there is a lack of leadership in the U.S. on climate warming, including, quote, nothing out of Congress, unquote. He further states the lack of leadership has led to uncertainty on the part of U.S. citizens on how much support they should give to climate change. In TheGuardian.com, their report on the Working Group 2 report was entitled Climate Change Report Should Jolt People into Action. In response to this release, Secretary of State John Kerry stated, read this report and you can't deny the reality. Unless we act dramatically and quickly, science tells us our climate and our way of life are literally in jeopardy. This article indicated the Working Group 2 report pointed to a warming climate as a driver of violent conflicts, migration, and increasing poverty. It has been a factor in the rise of mega disasters, heat waves, droughts, and wildfires. The potential for humanitarian crises are at the forefront of all these risks. A few notes about the United Nations International Panel on Climate Change. They have been studying global warming since 1988. All contributing scientists are volunteers. Their role is to review all relevant research with primary focus on peer-reviewed published research. They do not conduct their own research. They have an extensive multi-level process for development and review of their reports. All member governments can review and comment on their reports. Exhausting? Yes. Time-consuming? Yes. Thorough and comprehensive? Yes. A hoax or a conspiracy? Delusional. The online Washington Post published an article on November 1, 2013. Tea Party Republicans are biggest climate change deniers, a new Pew poll finds. According to this article, 75% of Tea Party Republicans deny the Earth is warming. The most disturbing poll result is only 44% of the American public believes climate warming is due to human activity, despite massive scientific consensus on the issue. At a time when dramatic and immediate action is needed to reduce emissions and adapt, the majority of Americans are woefully ignorant, many perhaps deliberately so, failing to make the connection between human activity and global warming. A disinformation campaign funded by fossil fuel interests and perpetrated by the right-wing media and ideologues has been very successful in creating doubt, minimization, and denial of the dangers we collectively face. The most extreme mouthpieces involved are exemplified by Rush Limbaugh, whose reasoning allow him to publicly proclaim global warming is a hoax concocted by the left. In the U.S., the critical mass has yet to develop, which will lead to significant societal reactions to the worldwide dangers encroaching upon us. This is inherently a very precarious and dangerous situation. Until next time, this is Dave Mitchell with Global Warming Corner.
You have been listening to Radioactive Magazine, a locally produced broadcast spotlighting social and political activists in our community. If you'd like more information or like to comment on this program, call Bill Claus at 816-994-7869.